You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm bringing you a conversation as a comedian returns to the show, having first taken part for about 8 seconds in some sort of Christmas special jape many years ago. This is Michael Legg. So technically Michael Legg returns, but this is basically his first appearance. If you're not familiar with Michael's work, he is an absolute tornado of righteous anger wrapped inside a very cuddly Northern Irish man. Cuddly in the sense, not in reference to his entirely slim and average build, but he's just so warm. He's just able to, I mean, he genuinely makes me laugh till I cry, and he is just such a brilliant combination of wrath and warmth. So without further ado, recorded live at the Objectively Funny Festival just a week ago, this is Michael Legg. You will remember that some years ago, as a little Christmas special gag, I interviewed this man for 45 seconds. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome returning to the show, Mr. Michael Legg.
This is nice.
Michael?
It wasn't 45 seconds, by the way.
Was it not?
No, it was about two.
It was. I just thought, what did
yeah,
I say?
Yeah, yeah.
Did I say?
Unless there's a director's cut that I don't know anything about. That'd be lovely. Hello, everyone.
Hi. Hi. This is Michael Legg. You will be no stranger to this this room.
Genuinely, I ran a club here in 1991.
91?
Yeah.
That would make you almost 50.
Yes. Yeah. Almost. I started a club here because I really loved comedy. No, I wanted to bang someone. I it's true. She couldn't get gigs anywhere, and I went, well.
Are you
when you say it out loud, it's the creepiest fucking thing that's ever happened, and I'm well aware that I should not have said that, but it's what I did, and I was young. I mean, it's very nice.
Okay, I feel like you have enough currency in the he's actually a good guy bank to be able to casually refer. perhaps not. For people who don't know you, I know. Let's get into this in a minute. Let's get into the remote possibility of someone in, for example, South Korea. Not
yeah,
knowing who
right.
you are. But so tell me about the club that you started here. This seems as good a
well,
place.
Well, it was an improv club. It was called Ad Hoc because that suggests.
This was pre internet, so presumably you weren't aware that almost everyone.
It was pre entertainment. It was. There was no such thing as happiness or indeed joy. It was just a typical... Oh, Stooges t-shirt, nice. It was just a typical... Sorry, I just pointed at the member of the audience who I now fancy. I'm going to start gigs here for you. Basically... Yeah, it was an improv show that you had like six people in. But do you know, one of them, what, like, I started this gig basically to woo someone, but I got like Patrick Marber in it. I don't know how Patrick Marber. I remember, see the bar there? The last time I met Patrick Marber and I did about 10 gigs together in this room. And I remember standing at that bar when he just goes, yeah, you know, I can't do next week. And I was like, oh, why not? I'm going to Paris. Oh, are you going to Paris? Are you? What are you doing in Paris? Oh, no, I'm moving to Paris. I'm going to go over there and write a play. Well, he fucking did that, didn't he? You're not supposed to, in comedy, you're not supposed to do the thing you say.
Yeah.
You're supposed to go, yeah, I'm writing a book. Of course you are. Come on, yeah, write a fucking book.
How long had you been doing comedy pre-1991?
No. Listen. Let's get this very clear. There is a massive difference between improvised comedy and comedy. Okay, improvised comedy is an embarrassing poison. it's sarcasm. It's clever and witty compared to improvised comedy. Yeah. Murder is the second lowest form of wit. Improvised comedy being number one.
And so let's define the terms here. By improvised comedy, do we imagine that you're asking members of the audience to shout out suggestions?
It was me and these other dicks thinking that we could in any way compete with like the Comedy Store players, who are a slick, well-oiled machine.
Okay,
you know, they're just they were born funny, and we met in basically self-help groups.
Who were the other dicks?
Oh, fuck. I wish I could remember. Neil Ashdown was one. Do you know Neil Ashdown?
I don't think so,
there you go. Oh, do you know why? Oh, fuck. Fred Piss, he was in it.
I know Fred Piss.
Yeah. Don't know if you remember. He did that school shooting in the mid-90s. Very funny, though, I have to say. Very funny shooting.
So was this your first kind of comedy outing?
Absolutely. I'm so stupid. I almost said the word naive, but no, it's not naive. Is it? It's just fucking stupid, isn't it? I saw an ad in Time magazine in 1990 saying improvised comedy workshop, and I thought workshop meant a talk. And okay. I went thinking, oh, I'm going to learn. No, I you have to get upstage and do it. And I went, like a wanker, went, oh, I really like this. Because improvised comedy is brilliant to do. It's just the worst thing in the world to watch. For anyone who has ever been at a bedside of a loved one as they slip away, you will know what it's like to watch improvised comedy.
Let's try and paint a picture of the young Michael Legg, 1990. What the Michael Legg in 1991?
Yeah.
Who you're in London?
Yeah.
How long have you been in London?
This room was in London at the time. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How long had you been in London?
When I did my first improv class, a year. So I was happily completely alone for about a year. And then I got my first sort of Fight Club-esque self-help group.
I've just remembered seeing a photo of you, a mm-hmm. black and white photo of you looking young and cool, standing outside the Comedy Store next to the
Yeah,
listings.
That's right. No, I absolutely loved the Comedy Store. I didn't miss a Comedy Store player's show for a year. And honestly, not a single one for over a year. Every Sunday, every Wednesday, I went. I was obsessed with them. I loved them, especially Paul Merton, who's to this day, I still think, is one of the most naturally, like, just off the cuff, incredibly funny.
And why had you moved to London? Was it to be...
I wanted to bang someone. There's a lot... There's... that's why I'm here. I want to bang someone. You're one of the prettiest people on the circuit. I was hoping.
Yeah, it's really working. It's I am very much charmed.
Yeah.
So, okay, so prior to coming over here, who were you as a kid?
Who was I as a kid?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, what's the rest of the question?
I'm just going to say something. You know, I said the three things to you before we start. The fourth thing, which I forgot, which I should have said, is that you're under no obligation to perform or try and be funny.
Oh, I never am, even while doing gigs. It's their problem, not mine.
So clearly, we are going to have a lot of fun listening to you be hilarious about everything. You are a very naturally funny person.
I've
been listening to loads of Do the Right Thing. I saw your show this year, which I loved, at the Edinburgh Festival. I saw my, up until that point, favourite show of yours, Tell It Like It Is,
that's
Steve.
That's very kind of you.
Which made me cry with laughter three times.
Right.
But we're not here to enjoy ourselves, Michael.
No. No. We must put aside such childish things. What was the question?
So the question is, who were you as a kid? Were you obsessed with comedy as a kid? Were you a funny kid at school?
Well, I mean, I sort of had to be obsessed with comedy, really, because my parents, I'm the youngest of five kids. My parents had four children before they were 27, maybe. Yeah.
The microphone may not have picked up a small wounded animal noise there from the audience.
Yeah. When I came along, there's a 2-year gap between every one of my siblings, except me and my second sort of, like, you know, youngest, I guess, sibling, which is the 4-year gap. My mum, trust me, my mum loves me more than the other kids, like by far. Like, she could still abort them because I am her absolute favorite, whereas my dad will gladly, and he's being honest, I mean, he's the one that tells the truth, and my mum doesn't. He goes, yeah, you were an accident. I was an accident. So I came up 4 years as opposed to the regimental two that they had.
Got it.
My mum tricked my dad. I don't know. Probably used a vagina on him or something. I don't know. I wasn't there. What I mean is, as a result of raising four children when you're so young, and by the time you're 30, you're exhausted with life. You're broken at 30. They had their fifth child, and they just went, oh, fuck's sake, switch the TV on, put him in front of it, there you go. And they got on with their life. As opposed to raising, I'm not saying that, you know, my parents don't love me. My dad tolerates me. My mum adores me. But TV definitely raised me. Which is why so many people, like my entire family speak like this. They have the proper Northern Irish accent. And a lot of people think my accent has changed because I moved to London. Trust me, my dad, Brian Cant, had an English accent, and that's why I speak the way I do.
Okay. So was it always growing up, was it always a dream of yours to live in London? Why?
No. In fact, if anything, I actually thought moving to the mainland to do anything other than take my country back was a disgusting act of cowardice. So, no, honestly, I find no interest in London at all, but I really did want to have sex with someone who had moved to London. So I thought, well, they're there.
Were you a happy kid?
Oh, yeah. Really. I mean, like, I had an absolute... If you can have an idyllic childhood during the Troubles, I definitely had it.
So for a happy kid with a great relationship with a mum that loved them.
Yeah, and my dad. My dad's brilliant. Yeah.
So one of the things I want to talk to you about, one of the flavours of your comedy, is a kind of howling anger.
Not picked up on it.
Does that?
I think that might be subtext that even I don't get.
You are phenomenally good at being angry, at being funny angry. And I'm interested in how much of that is in your real psyche and how much of it is a contrivance for the sake of comedy.
Honestly, if you met my mum, you would go, fucking hell. Michael Legg is basically a cover act because she's the absolute real... I mean, howling will take you fucking down, anger machine. Can I say this? Fuck it, I'm going to say it because it fucking happened. Basically, a gunman walked into our house one day and she fucking stood and went, fuck off! And... It was the first time I heard my mum swear. And it's a really weird thing for that to be the standout shock moment of when a mass gunman walks into your house. But, yeah. Mummy did a swear! Can't wait to tell Dad when he comes back on at 3:30 and points to a window.
Can I ask why a gunman came to your house?
Sure, but I mean, I'll keep this very brief. My mum was involved in a group called the Peace People, which was, you know, an incredibly noble organization. Basically, it did what it said on the tin. It just went, we'd like some peace now instead of all the fighting. But as a result, we would get threatening phone calls and stuff at the house. And, it's really hard to make this sound good. But I'm not kidding you. I look back at the troubles really nostalgically. I genuinely do. They were really lovely. Do you know what? In those days, you could keep your front door open. I mean, a man with a gun would walk in. But you get to hear your mum say, fuck off. And those were... Stuart, those were good days! My mum is a very, like, you know the way you've got, well, my mother was a very strong woman. My mum would knock your fucking balls in. And she would now.
And what was the cause of that anger in her, besides trying to bring up her kids?
Literally, it's just injustice, and it still is. Yeah. To this day, like, if you met my mum, she's in many ways a typical nearly 80-year-old woman, very sweet and all very adorable, and look at this thing I've baked and blah, 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 blah. Don't worry, it's vegan. That's how she is. But if you just go, well, do you know what? I think Thatcher actually had a few good points. Well, best luck to you, mate. I will back out of the room pretty fucking quickly because you're going to be taken down. She's a massive, massive lefty, whereas, you know, not everyone in Northern Ireland is.
Okay.
So, it's that.
So when you say you're a cover act for your mum, what's going on? What's really going on there? Is that an aspect, like, do you have a social anger that you can unleash in society, or is that separate to what you do on stage?
I should point out, my mum doesn't know she's angry. She has absolutely no idea. She thinks she's sweet and adorable at all times, and she practically is. She has no idea that, I mean, you know, she would gladly... batter everyone. Put it this way, my mum's nearly 80 now, so it was about 3 years ago, she was 77, and we sat together and we watched Avengers Assemble, right? She's a 77-year-old woman watching Avengers Assemble, and at the end of the film, do you know what the first thing she said was? Finally, they got the Hulk right.
Oh. What a mum.
Yep. Why would you, mum, find something that goes furiously angry and green at the drop of a hat?
So to what extent then is your anger a reflection of your mother's anger, or like your performative anger on stage?
It's definitely down to my mum cannot abide bad manners, and as a result, I can't either. Like, literally, any unnecessary noise drives me fucking insane, and I get that all from her.
So when were you first, or did you remember an early routine in your stand-up which had anger?
No, because you know what? None of my early stuff had it. No, it's not until like the last 10 I mean, I've been doing it for like 20 years, stand-up. Well, nearly 20 years. And it wasn't until 2008... I started writing a blog, and the reason I wrote that blog was just to keep... I didn't even know it was called a blog then. I thought it was just an online diary. And I thought, oh, I'll keep an online diary because I'm going up to the Edinburgh Fringe. And I thought that would be a nice thing to look back on at some point. But I did know that other comedians had kept what I thought were called online diaries. I won't name the comedians. No one will. They're not doing that well. But I'm pleased with that. But every online diary that I read, I just went, this doesn't say anything to me about my life as a comedian. They're like, oh yeah, I had to get up at 8 to get to the car, to get to the studio, and do you know what? Davina McCall was really lovely this morning. I just, who the fuck is this comedian? Where is the, oh, I got up at 8 you know, with a hangover, and just sat there and just did fuck all day. Didn't even watch TV. Just, I didn't even cry. That's how sad it was. Nothing happened. Literally nothing of any consequence happened.
And your that blog became very popular.
Within the comedy, or our comedy world. Yeah.
And not just comedians reading it.
I mean,
you started to gather a following then. That's
kind of... Yeah. Well, I just thought it was a really funny idea to have a comedian that was completely unsupportive. Because no one in the online world, I mean, now obviously everyone is a cunt online, but then everyone was like, look, I've had a cat for dinner, and here's a photograph of a cat on a dinner plate, and everyone was lovely and, you know, brilliant. And then I just thought, well, what if...
I'm trying to remember reading it in context of the time. I think that's... I agree with you that a lot of what was on the internet was very positive and it was people sharing.
But it was always people like, oh my God, can't believe it, you know? I mean, I was walking down the street and someone asked for my autograph. What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
You mean you had to sign something? Is that what you mean? Because that's not an autograph. Just because, you know, fucking bailiffs were taking away your stuff...
But it was at a time. Yeah. It was at a time when comedians were very excited about the ability to bang on about themselves online.
Of course it was.
And you definitely
cut
through that.
Yeah. And the thing is, like I say, I'm not going to name names, but there's five comedians who were all doing online diaries at the time, and within a week of my angry one, they all stopped.
And as a treat for coming along to the live one, once we stop recording, we're going to learn some names. So,
believe me, I am not discreet. So, I'm not indiscreet. I'll definitely tell you.
Great. So let's get to. So before we learn about the anger working its way into your stand up, what was some of your early stand up pre that period?
It was all about making the audience happy and cheery and sort of, hey, I was a compere, and I think you know, I was a good compere then.
Go on. Let's
no, I was a good compere then. I definitely got the room ready for an act, which I think is what a compere should do, as opposed to make the audience love them and no one else, which is definitely what some compares do. And, you know, some people sort of see it as like, well, just because they were better than you. No, that's not what it's about. It's definitely about getting the room ready for an act. And it feels slightly like, well, I better get the living room clean for the, you know, the vicar coming round. But that's only because that's exactly what it fucking is, you know. It's your job to make the room perfect. You can still be funny. And that's why so many people come up to you as a compere after the show and go, I don't know why you don't do comedy. Do you know what? I don't know why I'm not fucking nailing you in the eye.
But it was positive. The stand up you were doing was broadly positive.
It was
about
fucking
making
boring.
People
I mean,
happy.
It was. I mean, it was just. Like, I mean, do you know the most negative thing that I can possibly think that I was doing in the early days was telling a genuinely true story. Get ready to leave. Genuinely true story about how I played a practical joke on a girlfriend by when she was at work, I shat in a cat litter tray.
Okay.
Yeah. She really genuinely thought the cat was really... What the fuck? I mean... And I thought it was really funny, and she booked a vet appointment. And then, of course, it got to the point where, oh, hang on, something bad's going to happen to the cat. And I'd go, look, it was me. And you know what? I'm telling you this now, Stuart. No relationship survives that.
So this is Michael, really excited to get him on the show. Very much enjoyed this lovely little Bijou Festivalette recorded at the Albany in Great Portland Street in London. And I'm on holiday at the moment, so I'm not going to talk to you for much longer. Right now, I'm having the little post-Edinburgh decompression week that I would normally have directly after Edinburgh. That has been pushed forward till now as we go to Greece for my brother-in-law's wedding. So not much from me. A quick thank you to everyone that's donated recently. A big thank you to to everyone that's gone to comedianscomedian.com/donate to support the show in a variety of ways. And a big thank you to everyone that's done so by sharing it or giving it a 5-star on iTunes, especially if that person does not live in the UK. It's all the more use for me to get discovered elsewhere. If you'd like to join the Comedians Comedian Facebook group, we can have a more in-depth conversation and I can recommend stuff to you, and people can go on there and try and shift tickets for things at face value or less that they are no longer able to go to. So we had a brief chat about that, which had something like 65 comments, and people were overwhelmingly in favour of using the group for that. So you might be able to pick up some last minute bargains on there. But equally, I don't want it to purely become a destination for that. It is mostly an opportunity to find out who's coming up next, send me questions in advance, and communicate with me and the rest of the Com community. You just can't not call them that, can you? So details of the t-shirt frenzy coming up soon. I've nearly said fiasco, changed at the last minute. More t-shirts available throughout October when we get round to that, but I'll give you all the details as and when. And that's it for now. I had someone sent me a really funny email, but I can't find it, so I'll have to leave it for another time. Thanks for everyone that got in touch to tell me that 7 minutes is pathetic, and thank you to everyone that got in touch to tell me that a 7-minute run, this is a reference to last week's postamble, to tell me that a 7-minute run is terrible and I should do something with my life, and those who patronised me in a gentle and warm way to tell me that, hey, it's not so bad, many of us also can't run around. I'm pleased to say the following day I did go out, use my inhaler, and managed to do 15 minutes before I ran out of time, guys. I just had other things to do. I could have kept going. I absolutely could. Anyway, that will do for now. Let's return to the wonderful and, like I said, he's just like a lovely, warm, safe machine gun. This is Michael Legg.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I was expecting you when you said, "Oh, the pre the injection of anger into the material, pre that discovery of that, the shaping of that voice, that tone." I was expecting the example of an early material to be somewhat more anodyne than a true story about you pranking a girlfriend by shitting a cat. Yeah. So I can imagine laughing at that now with your current voice.
Yeah,
so,
but I probably could rewrite that. But you know, the way I wrote it was like, I can't quite remember, but I remember, like, it was basically like talking about bagpuss and stuff like that, you know, it was all that sort of like, we all know bagpuss.
And it was you were about to say before, it was boring.
Yeah,
was it boring to you? Was it boring to you to do, or is it just in retrospect?
Yeah, it was just shit. I was ashamed of myself when I did it.
As you were doing
But weirdly, I wasn't ashamed of myself when I was alone one day in a flat in High Wycombe shitting into a cat litter truck. Like, that doesn't shame me. I went, ha, ha, ha. Do you know what? You should always spice up a relationship. And what I've done is shat in a cat litter tray. No. So but I was really ashamed of the jokes that I added to the terrible event of that day. 9/11 had actually happened. 9/11.
Mm. So your
two things happened that day.
So the kind of
the abandon with which you, and we could all like, we absolutely.
Oh, that's the word I was looking for. I abandoned into the cat literature. I do apologise.
Do you see what I mean? The way that you are able to improvise in a really, like, in a really spirited, definite, kind of apparently mean, it has a delicious quality. Like, we're killing ourselves laughing now because you can riff on 9/11 while shitting into a litter tray. In a way,
it was a bad day, Stuart, and I don't think you can make light of that day.
So this version of you now, talk to me about how that started to come into
it. It just happened when I took... actually, I can tell you what happened. I saw a sketch comedy group that I was so jealous of that I went, I need to be better. And I was jealous of their work on stage, but I was also jealous of their lesson. I was jealous of their. I was just jealous that there was more than one of them. Do you know what I mean? There was. It's a sketch group called The Trap. And there's three of them, and I was jealous that they had each other. And I was like, oh, I'd love to, you know. Back then, I hadn't had a solo hour or anything, but just the idea of coming off stage and there was definitely another person, you know, in your group. I just thought, oh, God, that must be brilliant. And especially when their stuff was so funny. To this day, I mean, I think they're pretty much the best act I've ever seen. So I was jealous of what they had, and I thought, well, I could probably easily keep on being as boring as I am, and then dreading going to gigs and feeling unhappy on the way back.
Prior to that revelation, why were you keeping gigging? What was it in you that needed to keep gigging when you were dreading gigs?
I don't think there was a reason. I genuinely don't think there was a reason. I thought I was okay as a performer, but I knew by that stage in 2004, which is when I became, I'd seen The Trap in 2003 and 2004, but it was really in 2004 when I just thought, well, this is what they're doing is what I want to do. And they're a sketch group and I am not. But it was the style and the substance. They were making jokes that they sort of didn't give a fucking shit about. And something about that was just so utterly appealing. But mainly because they were really funny, but also it was like, we couldn't give a fuck if you don't buy into it and you don't find this funny. And this, I'm describing The Trap really badly because it sounds like they're cunts, but they sort of are. But I mean, but they, you know, they do. They do 8-minute long sketches based on, like, you know, like Patrick McNee doing a vocal on, you know, what's it called? Kinky Boots. And it's an 8-minute long sketch, you know, and it's like not everyone's going to, one, know what that song is, know who Patrick McNee is, or have the fucking patience for an 8-minute long sketch. And I did. And I absolutely, you know, I saw them on stage and saw, like, Paul Litchfield pissing himself night. I mean, literally. I mean, he wasn't pissing himself. He had a little thing in his pocket full of water, I assume. pissing himself every night because he was scared of chickens. And I went, just like this better. I like this better than, you know, whatever the hell it is I'm doing. So, I guess after that, I just decided, well, why don't I do other things to see if I can somewhat dip my toe into that? And The Trap and I, along with Margaret K. Bourne Smith and Zoe Gardner, we did like some shows together, which just made me feel better about being a comedian. And I think I could justify doing the shit stand-up because I knew I was doing something else.
So the something else was the shows with the Trap.
Those were the things that
and,
I liked.
And so in those shows, what was that a sketch show that you were writing with them?
It was, well, we started off with a show called, I don't know what the fuck it was called. I don't know. I'm sure we had a name for it. But it was funny. So there was that. But also then we did a run of shows called the Real Daniel O'Donnell Show.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. In this room. That's right. So, yeah. So, gee, it all comes back to this room, mate.
So, you were doing sketch shows there, and was that at the same time as you were blogging?
Yeah. I mean, we brought the real Daniel O'Donnell show up to Edinburgh in 2008, and that's when I started blogging. And in those blogs, early days, I don't know what the fuck took over me, but I just went, I'm name and acts, and I'm saying this shit. And I don't mean that I, Michael Legg, the real human being, I mean Stuart Lee, the character. I mean, which is what I call my onstage character. No one else will call it that, and it's really sad because I want to be as good as him. But I do. But what I mean is like, here's a really good example. Like, loads of comedians come up to me after this one blog, going, "Fucking hell, you just said like the most horrible thing about a fellow comedian," and I was really shocked that people were shocked. I mean, that comedians were shocked. That they're not people. But what I mean is, like, I was really surprised that anyone thought that I meant it. I just thought, well, it's... I thought it was pretty clear that, you know, I was just fucking about. And it, do you know what was? It was... I just wrote a blog about working with Alistair Barry, who's, an excellent comedian, which is now me saying that will ruin what I'm about to say. Because I thought it was a really funny line. I just wrote, oh my God, I've just been watching the topical material of Alistair Barry. Absolutely amazing. It's like watching Have I Got News For You on Dave. And I remember even Ed Byrne saying, I don't know, I think if you said that about me, I don't know if I'll ever speak to you again. I was like, God, that's... Maybe I've got the wrong end of the stick, but I just thought it was... I thought the idea of just being horrible as a comedian to your contemporaries was just really funny, because it was literally, you don't do that. It's up there with nicking material, isn't it? Like, you don't do that. So I did it.
And how was the fallout from that? Did Alistair have a problem with it, or was it other people?
Not at all. Not at all.
But a load of other comics did.
Yeah, and it was a bit weird. I mean, that's literally...
Elaborate on how weird it was. Well, did you feel that you had then done the wrong thing?
Well, yeah, I did for a bit. And that happens, and that does happen to me a lot. Like, when comedians get angry, then I just go, oh, God, have I done the wrong thing? But I've never done the wrong thing, Stuart. it was a joke, and but I guess the whole point of that blog, I mean, I didn't mean for it to do anything, but I guess the whole point was, it's sort of, I remember a comedian doing a comment on a blog, and they said exactly what I'd been feeling anyway. They just went, why don't you do this as your actual material? And not meaning these words, mean, why aren't you like this? And I think what they meant was, why aren't you funny on stage? And I went, yeah, you're right.
So
that's what happened.
So,
and that's why I'm now funny on stage.
And finish.
What a lovely story.
So, well, talk to me about that change, because I think some of the most interesting moments in comedy, the development, when an act changes, when you go, and I think it must be really hard to do, to put the brakes on and go, this isn't working for me. I hate it. I consider it boring and I hate myself. I've got to try and do this. There is a certain amount of there's a leap into the unknown there, even if you can write the stuff down and make it funny there. Talk to me about those first few gigs when you started to use that voice on stage.
Well, it was scary, but what I did was I went to rooms where I thought I'd be really safe. There's Robin Ince was doing book club in this room, and I basically lived here for about 25 years. If anyone can point to the door, that'd be great. And so I do little spots there, and there was just various other little gigs going on that I just thought might be a little bit easier to I don't even know if I was trying something out. I just thought, well, look, no one will see. So if I do it here, it doesn't really matter, does it? But one thing I will say, I've got an agent. Oh, yeah, I've got an agent, everyone. Oh, yeah. Places are going... Anyway, I'm going... It doesn't matter. No, I've got... I've got an agent, PBJ, Kate Haldane is my agent, and I guess we met 6 years ago, 7 years ago, and she said to me, well, you've got to do a solo show in Edinburgh, and I went, no, absolutely, adamantly, never going to do it, because I've got no interest in doing an hour-long show on my own. I'm not that interested, I'm not that into my stand-up. I mean, I know I can do it, but I'm just, I definitely wouldn't want to hear that for an hour. And but she was adamant. And it turns out I really liked it. Because what I decided to do for that first Edinburgh show was scrap everything that I'd done. You know the golden rule of stand-up comedy is you go up to Edinburgh on your first year and you do your best of. And I went, well, my best of's fucking awful. I just can't... I would hate...
Is that because the best of was the stuff you were doing previously?
Or yeah, best of, you know, is... And, you know, bag person, I did a shit in the kitty litter tray. But Emily loved him. That is literally the punchline to the routine, but I can't remember the routine, okay. So therefore... It's of no value.
So you threw everything out.
So threw everything out, and I thought, and I totally recommend that, by the way, to comedians. Just if you are going up to Edinburgh, I just chuck it all out and fucking start all over again. And you know, comedians also that just go, oh, I'm going up to Edinburgh, but I've got nothing. What I mean is they're not going to Edinburgh that year because they've got nothing. It's my biggest piece of advice. It doesn't matter. No one's got anything. Just fucking go up. It doesn't really fucking matter if you haven't got anything. By July, you'll panic so much that you'll get something.
That is a really good piece of advice.
It's beautiful. I'm very, very learned.
I'm forever telling when people, because of the podcast, often get in touch and say, oh, how can I start being a comedian? And I always say that the only advice I can give is book yourself into a gig as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Panic about it. You know, think about
absolutely.
It, worry about it. And then 2 days before, you will write 5 minutes of jokes because you absolutely have to. I think it's a really good kind of kickstart.
I've never done an Edinburgh show that doesn't have the final third making its debut in Edinburgh.
So talk to me about the writing process then, from the difference between that first one. How many hours have you done now?
5.
So the difference between the writing process for the first one and Jerk, the most recent show.
Yeah. I'm just comfier with it. I think I know, you know, the shouty bloke better. So I just said, well, I'm...
The shouty bloke, by which you mean your persona, really?
Yeah. My mum character, apparently.
So what was the first one about? Did it have a theme?
Yeah, it was about... they're all about the same thing, which is just be fucking nice. But the first one was strictly about good manners. And it had the routine that at the time sort of made me... Well, it gave me a bit of confidence that I thought
Which
I could do
what?
It.
What was that?
Well,
routine?
Basically, it was a New Year's Eve, and I was going from a gig in, I don't know, say it was fucking Richmond. It doesn't really fucking matter. To Teddington. I don't know. It was somewhere around there, right?
Just say A to B. That's
yeah. Fine. So I died on my arse at A. So I was on my way to B. No, I was meeting up with friends for a New Year's Eve party, and there was two kids. I mean, 15-year-old kids on the train, and they were smoking doobies, whatever, which might sound cool, but believe me, they do lead to problems. So. mainly me. I was the problem. And I went over to them, just went, guys, come on, you know there's no smoking on trains. And they were like this. Oh, yeah, sorry. I was like, oh, well, that was easy. And also, they seem really nice guys. I was like, yeah, you know what? They were 15. They're having a sneaky doobie. Who cares, right? And I sat back down. And they got up from their seat and moved to another part of the carriage. But it was like, it was still as near to me as they were. And they lit up again and... I just lost my fucking shit. Went over and just went, what did I fucking say? Imagine saying that. Imagine being an adult and saying that to someone. What did I fucking say? Like I've got any authority at all. And then I said to her, fucking, you know, fucking put that out now or something like that. And he just went, no. And I realised... that I'd... No, I asked him for his phone. That's what... Right, give me your fucking phone. Like, I was... Right? And I just went, no, you're not getting my phone. And I realised I've lost all control. And I turned to the other one. Right, you, give me your shoe. That's what a grown man said to a child. Yeah. And because that happened, and I realised, so I went, oh, I see how you write comedy now. You just go, I wonder what would happen if I said this in real life. And then afterwards, you go back and go, well, this is what happened. And you just write some jokes around it.
Okay.
As long as, you know, you've stepped far too far, I think you can get some jokes out of it.
So have you ever been in a position where you've thought, I've got nothing for the middle 20 of the show?
Yeah.
I'd better do something.
Yeah. Oh, listen, I've got a great example of that. It was a show I did a few years ago. And the opening 20 happened like 2-3 weeks before Fringe. And it was a blessed fucking relief because I had nothing. I had maybe a half hour show. And what happened was I was walking down the street and some like teenagers on roller skates told me to get out of their way, and I went, I'm not going to get out of their way. That's what I thought.
With a view to...
I just went, there's loads of them. There's only one of me. Let's see where this goes. Instead of just being an adult and going, don't matter. I went, no, I'm going to see where this goes. And it literally is my writing tool. Because I refused to move. Then they skated off the pavement onto the road, and then they came back onto the pavement and come up behind me and circled me. And they were threatening me like fuck. And I was going, instead of going, oh, all right, I've gone too far, I was going, fuck you. I was literally threatening. I mean, obviously I'm not physically threatening. But I just, in my head, it just went, I wonder what will happen if I don't back down. And as fate would have it, a punchline was given to me by my own fucking stupidity. They were all wearing roller skates, all of them. And at the end of it, when they were all being really aggressive, I just went, fuck you, National Express. To a right? And then I realised what I meant was,
Starlight Express.
And so, but the thing is, both phrases just confused them. So it's like, what? Oh, I meant Starlight Express. What? And you've never, I mean, it was such a threatening place to be, and yet it was diffused by just being, like, unfortunately being an idiot. So I'm really glad I did it.
It seems to me that a kind of a key component of your material, of your writing process, is the ability to really be honest about what a terrible person you are.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
But do you know what I mean? You're not afraid to mine your own awfulness,
But it's because I cannot bear people mining their own fucking brilliance. I just can't bear it. It's like, no one's brilliant. Gandhi, cunt. Everyone is shit. He wore fucking curtains. What the fuck is wrong with him? And also, you know, if we really wanted peace, fucking put a gun in your hand. Fucking sort these things out. That's what my mum would do. No, but what I mean is, it's like, no, I just can't... You know what? I'm not saying... Listen, we're lucky that we know a lot of really, really brilliant comedians who are really brilliant guys, but we definitely know some right fucking dickheads. Keep recording. You know, and I just... the idea of constantly bigging yourself up, or even bigging yourself up once, is just... How do you not hear yourself? So I find it much... it's much more relatable to sort of go, guess how terrible I am.
And is there any cost to you? Like, I'm thinking specifically of the final part of Tell It Like It Is, Steve, where you talk about this awful moment of saying to one of your musical heroes,
and him hearing you you... I don't remember...
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it's Steve Rothery. He's the guitarist from Marillion, which... massive cheer for that. and I was in the front row. It was like a gig, and I was right at the front in 1985, so I was 17. And when he was about to do a guitar solo, I shouted really loudly, not just in front of him, of course, but in front of anyone around me, "Tell her like it is, Steve!" Like it was some impassioned bit of poetry, when all it was just cuntery. I mean, it was just like this poor lad doesn't know how to be. But the great thing about that was... It sort of flanked up. I'm going, oh yeah, that is what I'm like. I mean, I didn't realise at the time. I realised much later. Right? Yeah, I've got the ability to just be awful.
And does it cost you anything to admit that kind of stuff on stage?
Are you happy to sort of? I don't think so. I think it's much more likely the other way. I think the idea, like, you know, comedians go on stage. Go, do you know what? I was doing a gig the other night at the Comedy Store, and you go, why did you say that?
Yeah,
that's awful. Did you die on your arse? Did you? Because if not, I don't care. Yeah, I was on stage at the Comedy Store and someone glassed me in the eye. Oh, brilliant. That's good. No, that is a good story, actually. You know, I don't know why you're telling us this. I firmly believe this. There is no such thing as a successful comedian. There just isn't. I mean, you can be Jerry Seinfeld and have loads of money, but Seinfeld points out all his flaws brilliantly. Yeah, and the idea of success in comedy, I just don't think there's a place for it. I mean, I was about to say I might be wrong, but I've just thought about it. I'm not.
Of your five Edinburgh shows, is there one that you feel you particularly nailed it? Is there one of which you're most proud?
I think Tell It Like It Is, Steve's probably the best one, but it's not my favourite one.
Did that have the Hunter story in it?
No, I can't really remember what that one was. Okay. I think that might have been the first one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Might have been, yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
And is there...
I was a hunter for a while.
I've asked you to kind of repeat a lot of your material. We won't go into the hunter story. Is your stuff available online or any of your
Edinburgh
shows?
No, I've got no interest in anyone ever finding it or hearing it again.
Well,
I'm actually recording Jerk, my last show. I did record one of my shows years ago. I didn't even listen to it. I just fucking hated it so much. I didn't hate the show. I just hated the idea that there was a recording. So I've never listened to it to release it, but I am recording. Other people are recording it, so they'll do it all. And you know,
so is there then that idea of there's no such thing as a successful comedian? Does that hold you back in terms of your career, whereby you don't want
to hold
do
myself?
Things?
No, I hold myself. Yes, yeah, yeah. Because I just think, well, it's not what I would do, is it? You know, it's not, and I think...
Like, you can't really self-promote, you can't really...
Well, I mean, I go on Twitter and go, guess what, I'm doing a gig. But to me, that's like, you know, that's more of a cry for help. I mean, it's rather than, you know, it's not like a PR company's done that, it's me just going... Hiya.
But like, for example, in Edinburgh, like, you've done the same room, you've done Stand 2 for a good lot of years on the bounce in a way that I sort of feel it's a great room, but I feel you could be doing bigger rooms and taking risks to get bigger crowds.
Well,
that is
definitely the next step for next year. That's thank you for bringing that up. That is definitely what's going to happen next year.
And do you? But already you sort of feel like a bit more humble about that, like a bit like,
yeah, yeah.
Like it's not very you to try and be successful, almost.
Yeah. Well, who cares? I mean, that's the main thing, isn't it? I mean, who cares?
No, I mean, I'm not saying it's not very you to be successful. I'm asking if that's a thing that occurs to you.
Yeah, definitely does. But also, but I think ultimately, the very fact that you talk about it publicly, like that, it's the most important thing. Like, who cares? Who cares? Stuart, I just asked you a question.
Tell me about... Let's talk about Fuck a Thing.
Oh, well, that's one of the classics. Maybe we should bring that back. Fuck a Thing was...
Fuck a Thing was so good. I had no interest
in Twitter.
Yeah,
but you have to understand...
Apart from
you have
Fuck
to understand, Twitter is so different, right? If we explain Fuck a Thing really quick, really quickly... I can't even say quickly. Fuck a Thing is a thing that I put on... Twitter years ago. I don't know, 5 years ago, 6 years, I don't know. And I just asked a very simple question, which was, if you had was always in capital letters, if you had to fuck A, and then you just come up with A, like a supermarket, which one would it be, full stop? I'd go with Tesco's. She looks up for it. That would be it. And the thing is, the replies would always be really funny. And, like, people would actually write proper frickin' jokes to go along with this. And I was like, and all I had to do was retweet and retweet and retweet and lose followers. That's all I had to
do. That can't have made you lose followers. That was a brilliant use of...
You are very wrong, my friend. I used to hemorrhage followers on those days. And the thing is, I would always say, by the way, if you're not enjoying this, just mute me for about an hour. But people would just go, well, I'd just rather get rid of you.
And one of the things I loved about it was that you would go, hey, Sunday, 4 p.m, let's play Fuck a Thing. And then you'd say that the previous day and everyone would kind of check in on time.
It was really, really, it's really, really good fun. But then again, it got really popular, so I thought, well, let's just stop that.
Well, this is it. This is it. Mm. That's what I want to get to the heart of about you. Why is it?
Do you know how popular it got? Someone from Six Music, I don't know his name, but he definitely does the breakfast show on Six Music, nicked it.
Really?
Yeah, fucking nicked it. For a toilet. I mean, he's probably a really nice bloke, and someone else on his team nicked it for him.
I mean, you can't put Fuck a Thing on the radio.
No, it was like, make sweet love to a thing or something like that.
Ow.
But it was like, so if you could make sweet love to a statue, which is definitely one that I definitely used before.
What
a
shame.
Hang on.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway.
Okay, so leaving that issue aside, I want to get back to this idea that you... That idea of being too successful, like, this is getting
too successful.
I'll stop.
Well, I mean, I don't think that I would necessarily not open the door if opportunity knocked.
Sure.
But, you know, like, you know, I think, that fuck, I really can't pin a lot of hopes on Fuck a Thing. I mean, once CBeebies turned it down, I thought, well, where else can you go? But I do know what you mean. Like I had this podcast for a while, and it got quite successful. It was called Precious Little, and then I just went, it's too many people like it. I just want
why?
To
what is that? Why is it the too many people?
I think once it's popular, it's boring, though, isn't it?
Why is that? Is that? Do you think that's reflected in the music that you like? You tend to like music that is. Do you know what I mean? Is it a similar thing to when you go, oh, too many people are into this band now, I'm going to stop.
But do
liking.
You not? Do you not think it's art is... Oh, God, I've just said it now.
Got him.
Do you
fire
not think,
your confetti cannons now.
Do you not think art is more interesting on its journey than its destination? So who gives a fuck?
God, that was so... What I love... That was such classic Michael Legg. It's a genuinely profound thing with a bit of swearing in at the end in case it felt too successful a thing to have said.
Don't you think?
Art is more... say that
it's
again.
More, it's more interesting on its journey than its destination. Who cares? I mean, the destination's meaningless, right?
Why do you say that?
Because once you're there, it's done. Right?
So
that's what destination means.
That idea of the destination being boring, do you think that holds you back? Like you said,
I don't think it holds me back, because I don't think it's important. How can something trivial hold you back? If you're not caring about it, you're not thinking about it, well, and it's not for you, how can it possibly hold you back? So it's a bit like saying, you know, Michael Bay's Transformers is holding back my career. Do you know what? I've not seen it, and I don't give a fuck about it. It's of no consequence whatsoever. I don't hear good things about it.
So does that mean you're happy as a comic because you're always... On the destination.
No,
you're always traveling.
No, and again, it's a bit like it goes back to there's no such thing as a successful comedian. Of course, I'll never be happy as a comedian because the job itself needs it definitely needs negativity, otherwise, it just can't possibly exist.
And is
because
that,
what is there to hold a mirror up to? If you can't hold a mirror up to joy.
So does that let you off the hook to have to be happy if you've found a way in which you have to be unhappy for the job to work?
What? sorry. You need to repeat that.
If you've found a job, if you've found a niche, a place in the world where you are celebrated for your anger and celebrated for your... and paid for the...
yeah, most important part.
Yeah. If your job is to be unhappy, to be professionally unhappy, to be professionally angry with things, does that kind of let you off the hook somehow in terms of your emotional life? Do you, like, I can't be too happy?
Here's a really good example. Right, I think Do the Right Thing is the best thing I've ever done. It is brilliant.
It is brilliant.
And I do think something amazing is going to happen with Do the Right Thing. Like, it's going to
You've shot a pilot.
Even that's trivial compared to, I think, what's going to happen to Do the Right Thing. I think something brilliant is going to happen to Do the Right Thing. Of course, the idea that I said this out loud might have dashed that already. But the thing about something like Do the Right Thing, one, its success, and its, I hope, ongoing success will be something I will always accept and indeed embrace. But more importantly, the idea that we might sort of like do show after show after show of us being, oh, actually, we're quite successful now, so we've got nothing to complain about, is bullshit. Because, do you know what? It would be the most boring comedy show in the entire world if it was just, well, who the fuck needs positivity? It's just... A friend of mine recently, she's been complaining about someone she knows, about saying that he gets angry at any negativity because you should only see the good in everything. But how the fuck can anything get done if you only see the good and stuff? How can any change happen? Do you know what? People aren't. But let's face it, if I've got a career, and it's definitely questionable whether or not I do, if I have a career, it's based around one thing. Switch your fucking boring mobile phones off. It's just fucking tedious. I don't want to hear your fucking noise on a train. That is it. But if I just accepted everyone was a cunt on a train, what is that ever going to change then? What I tell you what will change, me. I will change. I will go, well, you have to accept it. No, I want the world to change because I'm perfect.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Michael Legg.
So that was Michael. Thank you to Michael. Thanks to everyone at the Objectively Funny Festival. Thanks to all the diehard ComCom crowd that came out. Hi Min was there. Dave from Australia was there. Andy McH was there. And plenty more people besides. And I also, before watching Michael, saw Sindhu V do a mini pre-hour show at that comedy festival. And she's definitely one to look out for. So look out for Sindhu if you see her name on a bill somewhere. She really made me laugh. So that will do for now. Hopefully next year I will get a little bit more involved with a certain London podcast festival that I attended this year as a punter, but would love to attend as a podcaster. And they really seem to be doing it very differently to the LA Podfest, which I've been to a couple of times, which is a sort of wristband, get into everything conference centre affair. This was at King's Place in London, which is very nice, just next to the Guardian offices, don't you know? And they've got some fabulous rooms where I saw a 200-seater, lovely full room watching The Bugle live, which was tremendous fun, with Anubhav Pal and Helen Zaltzman as the special guests, both of them very amusing, and the chance to shout, fuck you, Chris, in public. But that was great, even though the room seemed like it would be more suited to a cello recital. It really worked for some largely cricket-themed, news-based dicking about. So hopefully, if any of you saw me there, I kind of made mild eye contact with a couple of people who looked like they might have been about to say hello and then didn't. And of course, one doesn't like to presume, so I didn't say hi in case they were just looking at me. So so if that was you, then hey, hi, that was me. So I'm not going to give you any more post ambling today because, as I said, I am on holiday. I hope you enjoy this one. Thank you very much to Daryl Smith for all his sterling work thus far on the podcast. Thank you to
Anyone else to thank? Well, Dan and Asher, as ever, but I hope you enjoyed the Sashir episode. She is phenomenal. Coming up over the next few, Tim McGarry live at Belfast Comedy Festival. So do check in on that. You can have a Google of that, Belfast Comedy Festival in early October. And I'm going to be interviewing the star of Give My Head Peace, a seminal Northern Irish comedy sketch show, sort of their equivalent of Absolutely, I think, if my meanderings online are correct. And Tim McGarry is a very funny man indeed. So come along to the Belfast Comedy Festival. And then when I get back and back into post-Edinburgh post-holiday mode, it'll be writing day one soon. So I'll keep you posted on that as well. I'll speak to you soon. Take care. Bye-bye for now. Is that how I'm signing off these days? TTFN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.